So let's go to 1 Samuel 28. We're going to be going over chapter 28 and 29. When we left off here, David pretty much saw that Saul was going to continue to come after him. If you need a Bible, raise your hand. We definitely want to get a Bible in your hand. And so David took the easy way out. He took the pressure off of himself. I know what I'll do. I'll go into the land of the Philistines. Saul won't follow me into there. And so we had mentioned the last time that a lot of times that's kind of the way it is. We want to take the pressure off. And so we try to kind of acquiesce of kind of going the pass of least resistance. Because this one that I'm on right now is too difficult. And yet God has been showing himself faithful time and time again. Whenever Saul came out after David, David would become aware of it. God would do amazing things. Stopped him there in Ramah when he sent one troop after another to get David. And they fell down and prophesied instead. And then Saul goes and he falls down, strips down naked and prophesies. And so David was able to see that. They're out hiding by En-Gedi, and all of a sudden Saul's army comes there. He sees him in a cave there and cuts off the corner of his robe as we went through and then yells and said, "Hey, look what I could have done, but I didn't after all. And you know, you are still the Lord's anointed." And Saul, you know, pretty much admits his sin, and I'm not going to come after you again. And then, of course, he comes after him again. And so David goes into the camp and gets his spear and water jug and then again calls from the other side of the Wadi their valley and says again, "Look, I was right there next to you. I could have killed you, but I did not because you're the Lord's anointed. Please show me my sin and I will repent to you right now." And instead it's Saul that repents and says, "I have done evil. I am the one that's at fault here. And David, you are innocent and you are surely going to be the next king of Israel." And so God has already shown David several times that he's going to take care of David. And yet, David still flees to the land of the Philistines. And this is not where he is supposed to be. Nowhere during this time do we see him seeking the Lord. That's huge to me of what's going on here. It's interesting, in chapter 30, we are going to see him seek the Lord again. And it's going to be because of certain events that are taking place. So here we are in chapter 28. He has been with the Philistines for 14 months, okay? He has been going on raids in the southern part of Judah. And so King Achish there of Gath is actually thinking that David is raiding Israel itself and the people of Israel. But instead, he's been going out and killing the Amalekites and other groups of people and killing all of them so they would not report back to the Philistines of who they were and things like that. And so King Achish actually thinks that David is killing his own people, but he is not. I had somebody come up to me and said, "So it really wasn't sin because these people were people groups that they were supposed to get rid of anyway." And I agree with that. That's true. But I would say this: David could have stayed in the land there in southern Judah and done the same thing. He still shouldn't be in Gath, or I should say Ziklag. He shouldn't be in the land of the Philistines, and he definitely shouldn't be doing what he's about to do here, as we will see. So, starting here in chapter 28, verse 1, it says this: "Now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, 'You assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men.' And so David said to Achish, 'Surely you know what your servant can do.' And Achish said to David, 'Therefore I'll make you one of my chief guardians forever.'" And so he sees, King Achish sees this as an opportunity that once David fights for him and the army of the Philistines, that he will now be in his household forever. We will always have David and his reputation, what a fierce warrior is, and now he's on our team, kind of a deal. We're going to hold off right there of what's going on there, because that really attaches to chapter 29, as we shall see. So I'll hold my comments for that until we get there. Verse 3 of chapter 28 says, "Now Samuel had died. All Israel had lamented for him, buried him in Ramah, in his own city, and Saul had put the mediums and the spiritists out of the land." Now, no doubt Samuel's mention here is to remind us of the spiritual influence, or I should say lack of spiritual influence, the kingdom of Saul has. Samuel is gone. You might recall that Saul killed like 80 of the priests at the area of Nob, on the hill of Nob. And so he doesn't have a whole lot of spiritual input, even though he's going to try and seek the Lord's counsel when he sees the Philistines come. And he's going to try and find out either through visions or dreams or consult a prophet, but God isn't speaking to him. God isn't speaking to him at all. And so it then gives us commentary that Saul had put the mediums and the spiritists out of the land. And so we have to give him credit for that. At least he got rid of the pagan spiritual influence, but he also got rid of the godly spiritual influences. And so the reason that's brought up is because he now is going to try that way. Well, if I can't get to God this way, I'll try and get to God through very pagan ways. So the word spiritist there out of the land, your Bible might say wizards or whatever, is the term that is familiar spirits. What that means is that this would be a person that has a familiar spirit, would have its own personal spirit, own personal demon, in which they would consult, who would then channel them information or just channel altogether, okay? And so this is where channeling would come from. As you know, the New Agers do a lot of channeling, and people from, you know, that lived centuries ago, and they'll speak to you and things like that. It's nothing more than demons is what it is. And it's been going on for a long, long time, a long time. And so that's what it is to have a familiar spirit. It's a spirit that's familiar to you. It's your own personal demon is what that comes down to. And so in verse 4, it says, "And the Philistines gathered together, came and encamped at Shunem. So Saul gathered all Israel together, and they encamped at Gilboa. And when Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him either by dreams or by the Urim or by the prophets." And so quite often, God can speak through dreams, through Urim, which has to do with the priestly breastplate, and by prophets. And so, and again, because he killed most of the prophets, he just doesn't have a whole lot of spiritual input. And so God's not speaking to him at all in any manner that he's trying. And so it's interesting how he even wants to pursue the prophets after having killed so many of them. And so Saul said to his servants, "Find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servants said to him, "In fact, there is a woman who is a medium in at Endor." So for one, this is amazing to me. He got rid of all the mediums and spiritists in the land, but it seems to me that some people close to him seem to know where this woman is. And so it makes me kind of wonder, I wonder if these people have been going to her. You know, just people in his own camp. Just a thought. I want you to go to Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy chapter 18. In Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 9, God tells Moses and his people this: "When you come into the land which the Lord your God has given you, you shall not learn to follow the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, or one who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer." A soothsayer is just somebody who gives you soothing words and basically tells you what you want to hear, is what a soothsayer is. "Or one who interprets omens," okay, "or a sorcerer, or one who conjures spells," or witch or witchcraft, "or a medium," okay, "or a spiritist," familiar spirits, "or one who calls upon the dead," which is a necromancer, is what that is. And so we are not to consult any of those. "For all who do these things are an abomination to the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord your God drives them out from before you." Okay, so these aren't things that we're supposed to participate in. Now, there's a great debate out there of why would you tell somebody not to do something unless they really could, you know? Nowhere does God say, "I don't want you to go to the sun." I mean, there are certain things he could say, "I don't want you to do this," but then there's almost an impossibility to it. Well, there's really not an impossibility today because, you know, what we can do with launching a spacecraft or something. But if he tells you, "Look, I don't want you to lift the Empire State Building," You know, why would he tell you that? You can't. Okay? So the thought is that if he tells you not to do something, it's because you can. So don't participate by being a necromancer. Does that mean you can speak to the dead? It means that you can do something that isn't going to benefit you. You're not supposed to speak to these spiritists or these mediums. You shouldn't. Is it all demons behind that? I believe so, no question about it. But there's some information there that they're privy to that can give you a short-term benefit, or nobody would do it. It's like sin. Nobody would do sin if it wasn't fun, and if there wasn't some sort of benefit to you. There is. It's very short-term, but at the same time, it will always take more than what it will ever give to you. So, can you contact the dead? God says not to. So I'm thinking myself personally, if you cannot contact the dead, you'll be fooled into thinking that you've contacted the dead. And who are you being fooled by? Satan, demons, the underworld, a dark, dark place. It's just not something you're supposed to do. Why? Because you can tap into that dark world. That's why. You can. And so he tells you not to do that. And there's a reason for it, because you can. So he tells us not to do that. In Leviticus chapter 19, just go to the left there a little bit. We're also told this. It says in verse 26, it says, "You shall not eat anything with the blood, nor shall you practice divination or soothsaying." Go down to verse 31. "Give no regard to mediums and familiar spirits. Do not seek after them to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God." It said time and time again in Exodus chapter 22, it says if you find someone participating, then you're supposed to kill them, remove them. And so God is very, very serious about this. And so understand, this is how far Saul has fallen. I can't hear from God. But he's trying to hear something. He knows God is real, but now he'll even do something that he knows that God completely forbids. But this has always been Saul's MO. He's been a very, very disobedient, rebellious person. And so in verse 8, it says, "So Saul disguised himself and put on other clothes, and he went and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night. And he said, 'Please conduct a seance for me. Bring up for me the one I shall name to you.'" So when Saul goes down to Gilboa, Mount Gilboa from Gibeah, that's about 50 miles away, when he's on one side of the valley where the Philistines on the other side of the valley, we're talking about 7 miles between Mount Gilboa where he is camped out and where Endor is. But the interesting thing about where Endor is, it's only about 2 miles from Shechem, where the Philistines are camped out for battle. So changing his clothes could have two reasons. For one, he doesn't want to bring any attention to himself, where spies of the Philistines will hear, hey, he's only about 2 miles away. The other one is that he obviously doesn't want to bring attention to himself to the witch at Endor. Okay? So he goes over here, and so he changes his clothes. He says, "Please conduct a seance for me. Bring up the one I shall name to you." And then the woman said to him, "Look, you know what Saul has done, how he's cut off the mediums and the spiritists from the land. Why then do you lay a snare for my life to cause me to die? Because I could do this for you, and then you could rat me out later on, and they're going to kill me." And Saul swore to her by the Lord. Wow. For one, how is a spiritist going to care that you swear by your God? Because they obviously don't believe in your God, or they wouldn't be a spiritist, they wouldn't be a medium. And so first he swears by his God, and he tells her this. He says, "Look, you know what Saul said. So Saul swore to her by the Lord, saying, 'As the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing.'" Now, how could he say that unless he's a person of authority? He's kind of given away who he is right there. So then the woman said, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" And he said, "Bring up Samuel for me." That should have been a red flag for her. Who else is going to want to consult Samuel than the king? And so the question is here about this woman. Also, a lot of people call her the Witch of Endor because she was obviously a witch as well. does this woman really possess the power to commune with the spirits of the dead? Has she deluded herself into believing that she has such power, or was she simply a con artist? And so there's an endless debate about this. Or does she really believe that she is contacting the person she thinks she's contacting, which we know is really a demon? The spirit of Samuel, though, I will say this, actually does appear. There's a lot of people say, no, it was an imposter. It really wasn't Samuel. Yeah, it was. And it makes it very clear, nowhere when we read this is there anything to make us, to suggest that it was not Samuel. That's my first line of defense in this. It was Samuel. And if it wasn't Samuel, there would have been some comment, there would be some verse that would allude to that. It doesn't. And so, if you ask me, this is definitely Samuel. It was definitely the view of all the rabbis, and especially the ancient rabbis that taught this text. We know that the early church fathers like Justin Martyr, Origen, Augustine believed this as well, but there were a few that didn't. Tertullian and Jerome maintained that the appearance of Samuel was some diabolical hoax or delusion. However, when you read the context here, and when you read this, there's no way you could come to that conclusion. There's just no way. And so, this witch could not have impersonated Samuel. She was very surprised that Samuel was there. Probably was surprised because her familiar spirit isn't the one that brought him to her. So she couldn't have impersonated Samuel. She didn't know that it was Saul at this time. And so it's very interesting to me when we look at this from here, from this point on, this witch becomes a spectator at this point. Samuel kind of takes over. It's a Saul and Samuel show. The witch is merely a spectator at this point. And we see this here in verse 12 when all of a sudden it says, and when the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. Because I believe who she was really looking for was that familiar spirit first. Okay? Because if she conjures up other people and then that person would show up, she was told to conjure up Samuel. Well, there's Samuel. Why are you so surprised? Because she usually probably first gets a familiar spirit. And that personized demon is the one that will take over her, and she would channel that person to whoever it is paying for her services. But there is no channeling going on here. There is no Samuel coming into her and her speaking for Samuel. She actually sees Samuel, and she freaks out. And so she cries out with a loud voice, and the woman spoke to Saul, saying, why have you deceived me, for you are Saul? Okay. And the king said to her, do not be afraid. What did you see? And the woman said to Saul, I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth. This is interesting. Because I've often said that Sheol is somewhere in the center of the earth, personally. People want to say there's different dimensions and things like that, but the Bible speaks about you ascend to heaven. That means go up. But when it comes to going down into Sheol, into the grave, that speaks of a direction, and it's down. It's down. It's in there somewhere, and it's ascending out of the earth. And Saul isn't going to be fooled into this. He has a specific question he's going to ask to make sure this is Samuel. That's great. You freaked out. Big deal. You figured out I was Saul. I'm surprised it took that long. He's not convinced yet. I personally believe he's not convinced yet. And it says, I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth. Now, this is interesting because the word spirit here is Elohim. And it speaks of the word gods. But it also is a word that's used for judges. Now, why would God use his name for judges? Because it is the plural form of a singular God, Elohim. Why would he use that when it comes to the magistrates, when it comes to the judges of Israel? Because the judges are supposed to judge with the righteousness of God. They are in place of God on this earth, and they are supposed to judge exactly as if God himself was present there in that courtroom. And so God calls them Elohim, judges, magistrates, is because they're supposed to implement my justice, my judgment, my righteousness. And Samuel was the last of the judges. And so he is an Elohim, he's a judge. And so when it says the Spirit ascending out of the earth, she's saying, I saw a judge ascending out of the earth, is what she's saying there. In Exodus 21, verse 6, it says, then his master shall bring him to the judges, Elohim. Same word. Same word. In Exodus 22, 8, it says, if a thief is not found, then the master of the house shall be brought to the judges, Elohim. Same word. And so this is what she sees. And so Saul, notice, doesn't see Samuel. He doesn't see him at all. And so he asks of her, he says, okay, I have another question for you. What is his form? Here's another question. He just wants to make sure this is Samuel. What is his form? And she said, an old man is coming up, and he's covered with a mantle. Now, I find this very interesting. He's an old man. Don't we sometimes think when we're, you know, as soon as we die, what do we look like and things like that? I just find that very interesting. I'm not 100% sure. I believe that once you die, absent body, present with the Lord, you have a supernatural body. But I'm kind of wondering, until the resurrection of your body, if you somehow kind of look the way you did when you died, but in kind of like Superman form, okay? You don't have the aches and pains anymore or whatever, you know, but you're going to be recognizable and everything else. And so here's Samuel, dies at an old age, and he comes back in that old form. Or it could just be so he'd be recognizable. Maybe that's it, and that's a possibility as well. But it says here, and he is covered with a mantle. And at that point, Saul perceived that it was Samuel, and it stooped his face to the ground and bowed down. And what seems to have convinced Saul was the description of Saul. He says he's wearing a mantle. The word mantle there is the Hebrew word me'il, and it means a robe. And I believe it's supposed to remind Saul of something that happened in 1 Samuel 15. When Saul was supposed to kill the Amalekites, he wasn't supposed to leave anyone alive, and yet he brings back the king. And so he wasn't supposed to bring back any of their oxen or sheep. He was supposed to slaughter all the animals as well. And yet he brings back the best of those things. And so Samuel approaches Saul and tells him, you have not obeyed the word of the Lord. You have sinned. And so Saul looks at him and said, okay, I've sinned. I understand that. But still, please honor me in front of the people. And so Samuel turns away from him. And as he turns away, Saul grabs his robe, his mantle, and he tears it. And so Saul tells him, he says, this day, just like what happened back then, he tells me, just like you've torn my robe, the kingdom has now been torn from you and will be given to another. And my thought is I wonder if he shows up in that robe that's torn in order for Samuel, or I should say Saul, to understand what is going on right now. What happened back then in chapter 15 is happening right now. You summon me up, I'm wearing the same robe that was torn, that you tore, that suggests to you that the kingdom is being torn from you and given to another. And why are you before me right now? Because the Philistines are coming, and they're encamped. And guess what? What was prophesied in chapter 15 is happening right now with the Philistines. So just amazing that the last time that Saul saw Samuel, it was in that robe that he tore, and it was a prophecy of the kingdom being taken away from him. And yet that's what's happening to him right now. And now Samuel says to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? Again, being brought up, not brought down, he's being brought up. And Saul answered, I am deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets or dreams. Therefore, I've called you that you may reveal to me what I should do. Wow. Most Orthodox commentators are almost unanimous in the opinion that the departed prophet did really appear to Saul, did really appear to Saul. And then Samuel said, so why do you ask me, seeing the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy? There are different wordings here of the word enemy here. I know the Septuagint says has become on the side of your neighbor. The Latin Vulgate says has passed over to thy rival. It's basically here to say, why are you even talking to me when you know that God is against you? And you're coming to me to try and find out what it is that you should do. You know what you should do, Saul? You should repent. You should just cry out to the Lord and you should just repent. But he doesn't do that. At least I don't think he does that just yet. And that's another time for a discussion. Verse 17, the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand, given it to your neighbor David. Why? Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord, nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. And here's another reason. Go to 1 Chronicles 10. We are told here in verse 13, so Saul died for his unfaithfulness which he had committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. But he did not inquire of the Lord, therefore he killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. Here's another reason this is being turned around. It just gets worse for him. It doesn't matter what he does, it's going to be added to the list of things. This is why you're just playing out what's in your heart, and you're just revealing to everybody what's in your heart. And so what's in your heart is you're willing to even consult a medium. If I say no, I'm not going to speak to you, you can't even receive that. And you're going to try and force my hand? Really? Wow. And he says, because, in verse 18, going back to 1 Samuel 28, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord, nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek, therefore God has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. And tomorrow you and your sons will be with, who? Me, Samuel. The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. And immediately Saul fell full length on the ground, and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there's no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day or all night. So what is he doing? He's fasting. He's doing other things and he knows what to do. The word fell means made haste, fell with fullness of his stature. He's exhausted because he's been fasting. And so it says, and the woman came to Saul, saw that he was severely troubled, and said to him, look, your maidservant has obeyed your voice. I have put my life in my hands and heeded the words which you spoke to me. Now therefore, please, heed also the voice of your maidservant, and let me set a piece of bread before you and eat, that you may have strength when you go on your way. But he refused and said, I will not eat. That's a good thing. That's a good thing right there. I will not eat. And I would tell you, this is why you should not eat. Because eating suggests fellowship. That's why. And you should have no fellowship with darkness or those who practice such things. I will not eat. So his servants, together with the woman, urged him, and he heeded their voice. Wow, what a surprise. Then he rose from the ground and sat on the bed. Just so you know, in dwelling places like that, a lot of times they would have like about 30 inches or so that ran against the wall. And so that could be used for a bed at night as well as a seat during the day with a table. And so that is the thought that is what's happening there. It's not as though he's in her bedroom or anything like that, but it could be used as a place for seating against the wall with a table in front of it, or at night it could be used as a bed. And so because it uses the word bed there, they're saying that this is probably taking place late afternoon. Now it's evening time by the time this is over with. And so it goes on and it says, now the woman had a fatted calf in the house, and she hastened to kill it, and she took flour, kneaded it, baked unleavened bread from it. I think that's very interesting. So she brought it before Saul and his servants, and they ate, and they rose and went their way that night. This is a terrible commentary on Saul here. He's just been rebuked by Samuel for not listening to the voice of the Lord, and here instead he listens to a witch, and his servants to eat. It should remind us to the time back in Eden when Adam also listened to the voice of the woman to eat. And so Saul eating with this woman, this medium, this witch, is a good example of what it is to eat at the table of demons. Because in 1 Corinthians 10:20, Paul tells us, rather, that the things with the Gentiles sacrifice, a sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I don't want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. Saul has no business with this woman. And especially after seeing Samuel, he should realize, I just need to leave. And I need to go repent and say, okay, Lord, if I have to die tomorrow, then so be it. But I want to die with a good conscience and just be right before you. And I know that your will is going to be done. Forgive me for consulting with a medium. Forgive me for this. Forgive me for that. Samuel made it very clear. It's because of my disobedience back then. I'm going to ask forgiveness for that. There's all sorts of things he could have done. But instead, he eats. And he has no business fellowshipping with this woman. And it doesn't seem to bother him that he's receiving anything from her. Why? Because he has no fellowship with God. And so he shares in this counterfeit Passover meal of sorts. He's going to be eating unleavened bread, just like at the Passover, just like at the Exodus. Why unleavened? Because we don't have time. It's made in haste because you now have to get up and leave and get out of the land of Egypt. It's a preparation for a quick exit out of Egypt. And Saul's going to exit all right. He's going to exit out of this world is what he's going to do. Now let me ask you this. Where did Saul go after he died? Well, according to verse 19 here, he's going to go to the place where Samuel is. He and his sons. Now there's two thoughts to this. And I'm not beholding one to another. I have one that I hope. But the place where Samuel is known as Sheol, the grave. Okay, it's a place where the dead go. But as I've taught before, there's a place in Sheol for the unrighteous dead, and there's a place for the righteous dead. And we see that in Luke 16, and there's a chasm between them. So one can't cross over. So the thought is that the place where Samuel is in Sheol, even though he's in the section of the righteous dead. And so the argument is made is that if Saul is not saved, if Saul is not going to spend eternity with God, he is still going to the same place as Samuel. He's going to the place of the dead. But he's going to be on the side of the unrighteous dead. It's a possibility. I don't know. I don't have to make that judgment. I praise God for that. But there are those who also believe that if he and his sons are going to the same place, it could be the same thing. It's the place of Sheol where Samuel is. But Jonathan and Samuel will be in the place of the righteous dead, and that Saul would be in the place of the unrighteous dead, or those who think, no, he's going to be with Samuel, and to just be in the place of Samuel isn't the same as being with Samuel, and so that is speaking of he's on the place of the righteous dead. Your call. But I would say this. I believe that there are some things that happen in chapter 30 and in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel chapter 1, where there was definitely some time for Saul to cry out to the Lord when he was dying. And I have no idea what he said in his last breaths. And my hope and desire is he cried out to the Lord. That's what my hope and desire is. Now, going down here to chapter 29. Then the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek, and the Israelites encamped by a fountain which is in Jezreel. Now, chapter 28 and 29 are not in chronological order, okay? We know this because Samuel tells Saul that he and his sons are going to die tomorrow, okay? Well, in 1 Samuel 28:4, it says the Philistines gathered together. Where did they do this? In Aphek? And then what? Rest of verse 7 says, and they came and encamped at Shunem. Well, we're told here that they gathered together in chapter 29, verse 1, in Aphek. But in chapter 28, verse 4, we show them encamped in Shunem. And that's about 45 miles away from each other. Now, I have on here show slide because I meant to shoot Frank a slide that I have in my computer, and I forgot to do that. But if you look at the land of Israel, they're both going to the north. About 50 miles is Gibeah to Mount Gilboa, where they are, and from Aphek to go to Shunem is about 45 miles. They all go parallel with each other, but what's in between them is a lot of mountains and rugged terrain. So that's why they go and meet where? That's the Valley of Jezreel. This is where they're going to fight. And so when chapter 29 is taking place, they're still at Aphek. This is where they're gathering their army. This is where this event takes place. And so after they gather armies, they go to this place, Shunem, which is in verse 4 of chapter 28. And so this is why I said it really is better to use the very first two verses when it comes to chapter 29, because it builds up to what's going on here. And so Endor is about 7 miles from where Saul was camped, and Gibeah to Mount Gilboa is about 50 miles. Aphek to Shunem is about 45 miles. And so when we read 1 Samuel 28, verses 1 and 2, and then 1 Samuel 29, it fits together a whole lot better of what's going on here. So going back to 1 Samuel 28, 1, it says, "Now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, 'You assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men.' So David said to Achish, 'Surely you know what your servant can do.' And Achish said to David, 'Therefore I'll make you one of my chief guardians forever.'" Now, I'll say this when I encapsulate this in the end, but there are those who think that David is actually planning to turn on the Philistines when they go into battle. And so when he says to Achish, "Surely you know what your servant can do," it's kind of like, just you watch. Because when I'm in battle, I'm going to turn and I'm not actually going to fight my own men. There are those who think that, okay? I'm saying it's a possibility. It's not where I come from, but it is a possibility. Verse 1 of chapter 29. "Then the Philistines gathered together at all their armies at Aphek, and the Israelites encamped by a fountain which is in Jezreel." Endor actually means fountain of dwelling. So, again, we already know that they're encamped over there waiting for the Philistines to come. And it says in verse 2, "And the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish." And then the princes of the Philistines says, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" Notice that he qualifies them as Hebrews. Hebrews should not be with the Philistines. It's obvious. These Hebrew men, they worship a different God. What on earth are they doing here with us? And so Achish said to the princes of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me these days or these years? And to this day I have found no fault in him since he defected to me." But the princes of the Philistines were angry with him. So the prince of the Philistines said to him, "Make this fellow return, that he may go to the place which you have appointed for him," which was Ziklag, "and do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in battle he becomes our adversary. For with what could he reconcile himself to his master, if not with the heads of these men? And is not David, of whom they sang to one another in the dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands, but David is 10,000s? They don't trust David. They look at it and go, "Wow, what a perfect opportunity for him to go out and battle with us." But then in the heat of the battle, all of a sudden he turns on us, and then he starts to destroy us in order to build himself in favor and in good light again with Saul. It's a good, clever scheme, if you ask me. And there are those who believe that that's exactly what David was planning to do. And I would say that's a possibility. I'm not sold on it, but it's a possibility. So, verse 6, "Then Achish called David and said to him, 'Surely as the Lord lives, you have been upright, and you're going out and you're coming in with me, and the army is good in my sight. For to this day I have not found evil in you since the day of your coming to me. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not favor you. Therefore, return now, go in peace, that you may not displease the Lord's of the Philistines. Now, I find this interesting. When Achish uses the term, as the Lord lives, the word Lord there is Yahweh. Now, there are also those who believe that maybe Achish has embraced the God of David. That is a possibility. Later on, when, and I can't remember exactly where this is, so I'll have to look this up for next time, and I'll make sure I have this. But there's an area where the Philistines are going to be judged, and they're cursed, and every one of their cities is mentioned except for Gath. And the understanding there is because if Achish came to know the Lord, his God, and because of the favor that he bestowed to David, that there's a little bit of favor that is coming from the Lord there as well. But it's very interesting that Gath isn't mentioned there. So, and I'll start the next study with that because I just don't have it with me right now. And so in verse 8 it says, "So David said to Achish, 'But what have I done? And to this day have you found in your servant as long as I have been with you that I might not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?' And again, there'll be those who would say that when he's actually saying 'my lord the king,' it was just a subversive way of speaking of Saul. And so he wasn't necessarily saying that Achish is his lord, his king. I don't buy that one, personally. But it's a possibility. It's a possibility. And then Achish answered and said to David, 'I know that you are as good in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the princes of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to battle. Now therefore, rise early in the morning with your master's servants who have come with you, and as soon as you're up early in the morning and have light, depart.' So David and his men arose early to depart in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel." So, there's a couple things that I look at here. And I can look at as how this happens to us from time to time. I always try and look at this and try and say, okay, how can I bring this into my own personal life? How is this something that can practically speak to me? And I got to tell you something, there's a huge warning flag here for every Christian, for every believer, that you could be exactly like David. You could find yourself in the wrong camp. And you have to ask yourself how you got there to begin with. And it's usually incrementalism. It's usually just taking a liberty here and there. And the next thing you know, you're in the wrong camp. And you know what's interesting to me? It's people in that camp, where you shouldn't be anyway, are the ones that actually point it out to you. Isn't it interesting that David should not have been there with the Philistines in their camp, willing to go to war against Israel? He should not, as of chapter 27, as we taught before, he should not have gone into the land of the Philistines. That was wrong. That was sin. God had provided for him and protected him while he remained in the land. But as we talked about, that when you have this peace, because you look at it and go, I'm weary, I don't want to fight this battle anymore, and so you go to the path of least resistance, which was going to the land of the Philistines, David had peace for a while. But now he's not going to have that much peace, in the sense that now he has to think about, I'm going to be going fighting against my own people. But then God intervenes and says, no, go back. But as he goes back, he has a momentary peace of probably going, well, at least I didn't have to fight my own people. But then when he goes back to Ziklag, as he's going to find out, as we'll find out in chapter 30, the Amalekites came. And they took away his wife, both wives, his wives, took away all the children and the wives of the other men, took away all their sustenance that they had. And so he came back to an empty place. And Ziklag was burned to the ground at that point. Do you think he had peace at that point? He had no peace. He had no peace. He had a temporary peace when he first went into the land of the Philistines. There's no question about it. And while he was in that land, he actually had the Philistines themselves say, are these not Hebrews? Didn't you guys know that you were Hebrews? What are you doing with the Philistines? Have you ever found yourself in the camp of unbelievers? And then one of those unbelievers are the ones that have a higher standard for you than you do? And they say, aren't you a Christian? What are you doing here? Aren't you a Christian? What are you doing watching this movie with us? I thought you were a Christian. What are you doing sleeping with him or her? They have a higher standard for what you've told them your faith is than you do. You're in their camp. Aren't you a Christian? What are you coming to happy hour with us for after work? I've never done that before. Aren't you a Christian? You're in their camp. And they're thinking it's an odd thing. We know you're a Christian. What are you doing over here? They have a higher value or standard of what you're supposed to be than you do. And you've become ashamed at that. I've been called out for that before, several times in my early walk with the Lord. And I remember how humbled I felt by that. What are you doing here? Christian? I was kind of hoping you wouldn't notice. Pretty sure that's what David was thinking. Hope they don't call me for being a Hebrew. Hope they don't call me because I'm supposedly a man of God. Hope they don't call me out because... And yet the world will do that. The Bible makes it very clear in 2 Corinthians 6, says, do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what is fellowship has with righteousness, with lawlessness? What communion has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God, as God has said, I dwell in them, I walk among them, I will be their God, they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. David is yoked with the Philistines, willing to go to war with them. And David is a lot like us, that we sometimes find ourselves in the enemy's camp. We're in the wrong camp with the wrong company. Just like 1 Corinthians 15:33 says, do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts what? Good habits or morals. We have no business being over there. No business whatsoever. I find it's interesting that yet through all this, God never abandoned David. He's a work in progress. And he's failing in different areas, but God is still there. 2 Timothy 2:13, if we are faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. Thank you, Lord, for that. That you're still walking with us. But David is definitely in a place that he should not be. He shouldn't be there. And when he goes back to Ziklag, his greatest horror is going to be upon him. His whole family's gone that he brought over to Ziklag to keep them safe. All of his other men's family, they're all gone as well. As we'll see, they are so upset with David, they're going to want to stone him. And then the most precious words jump off the page. David sought the Lord. Because that's what it took. This is what his decision-making brought him. But the neat thing about David is that he saw that and he sought the Lord. Saul could have done that any step of the way. He could have truly have sought the Lord. He could have just repented and he could have sought the Lord. He didn't do that. I just want to really caution you in your walk with the Lord that if you find yourself in the enemy's camp, I think after hearing this study especially, you're going to hear someone call you out on it. And it should be a real eye-opener. Go, man, how did I get to this place? And all it takes is the same thing as we see in Revelation. Return to your first love. That's what Jesus told the church of Ephesus. You do all these great things, but somehow you meandered off the trail. Return to your first love.